and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Blue-Green Alliance conference call on climate change and infrastructure. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Kelly Schwinghammer. Ms. Schwinghammer, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rachel. Welcome, everybody, this afternoon to our Blue-Green Alliance press call on the passage of the Sandy Relief Bill and climate and infrastructure issues. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to David Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance.
Thank you very much, Kelly, and good afternoon, all of you, and thank you for joining us today. This is David Foster, Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance. For those of you who don't know us, we're a national partnership of 14 labor unions and environmental organizations representing over 15 million Americans who work every day to expand the number and quality of jobs in the clean economy. The House of Representatives this week takes up the Sandy relief measure. We are calling today on Congress to provide the full funding necessary to meet the needs of all communities affected by this disastrous storm and to pass it without any pay boards. The House and Senate must pass a full package of relief without these arbitrary and unnecessary pay boards that provides the necessary funding to meet the needs of people, businesses, and communities in the Northeast so that they can get back on the path to recovery. Now, one of the harshest lessons of Hurricane Sandy was that it exposed the terrible deficit in our nation's infrastructure and the vulnerability of millions of people in the face of climate change. Months after the storm, people in the Northeast are continuing to pick up the pieces after Sandy. Con Ed employees, members of the Utility Workers Union, are still working to repair and rebuild the electrical grid in some parts of the region. Nearly every bridge, tunnel, and road was closed down as a result of the hurricane. Flooding shut down our major subway systems. The storm is long gone, but the need to make major repairs to transit is not. Millions who rely on the transit system were stranded for days. Subway tunnels were flooded with over 4 feet of water. 43 million gallons was found in each tube of the Cary Tunnel alone. Sandy knocked out about 25% of the cell phone towers belonging to all carriers in a coastal area spread over parts of 10 states, and Sandy caused over 8.5 million power outages across 21 states. Now, the bad news is that in the face of the impacts of climate change, including increasing frequent and severe weather events like Sandy, we cannot continue to ignore the deficiencies in our nation's infrastructure. New York City alone, it was reported today, lost $5.7 billion in economic output. But the good news is that preparing for and addressing the root causes of climate change will create jobs, improve efficiency in the economy, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and expand the use of renewable energy. So today we're urging President Obama and Congress to prioritize the need to truly and immediately invest in our nation's antiquated and ill-prepared infrastructure. Doing so will create jobs and ensure that our nation is prepared for some of the future impacts of climate change. And if we do it right, we'll also be able to avoid the looming and ever-worsening impacts of that problem. So with that introduction, I'd like to now call on the first of our participants, Mike Langford, the president of the Utility Workers Union of America. Mike?
Thank you, David. Good afternoon. I'm Mike Langford, national president of the Utility Workers Union of America. We have over 50,000 members working on electric, gas, and water and nuclear industries across the United States. Right now, our members at Con Ed in New York are still working to repair and rebuild the electrical grid. Our members at New Jersey, PSE&G, meter readers, call center workers are vital to the system's reliability and public service, as our members are all up and down the East Coast. That's why we're here today. Congress must pass a fully funded relief measure immediately. The people of the Northeast need help, their communities, their homes, and their businesses back together after the devastation of Sandy. One of the harshest lessons was that it exposed the vulnerabilities, the terrible of the region's electric, water, and gas infrastructure. Our members have a unique perspective with regard to the impact of Hurricane Sandy, as demonstrated by the extreme and costly damage to homes, roads, rails, tunnels, and bridges. Many of our coastal cities simply cannot cope with the worst storms or higher seas. Utility worker members are among the first responders for disasters like Hurricane Sandy and are on the front lines of picking up the pieces in New York. Utility worker represents workers across the region who provide electric, gas, steam services in the area. The full weight of repairs and reconstruction can't be shouldered by local residents, workers, and utility companies alone. The problem is much bigger and requires long-term solutions. One example of how Hurricane Sandy revealed weaknesses in our infrastructure was through the extensive flooding that occurred during the after the storm. Destructive high winds during Hurricane Sandy caused significant damage. The tidal surge that caused water from the river to overcome a berm along the banks caused the widespread damage. Since the storm, hundreds of millions of gallons of raw and partly raw sewage from impacted plants have flowed into New York and New Jersey waterways, exposing flaws in wastewater infrastructure systems that could take years and billions of dollars to fix. Many of these plants are still only partially operational. Almost all wastewater treatment plants in the region are close to sea level and are vulnerable to storm surges. In addition, many were built decades ago to serve fewer people and require upgrades, in any case, just to keep up with population growth. In New York State alone, Governor Cuomo has estimated nearly $1.1 billion will be needed to repair treatment plants alone, state officials acknowledging that they may have to do far more. The American Society of Civil Engineers gave our nation's infrastructure a grade of D, and in many key areas such as wastewater management, a D-. The ASCE study found that aging facilities, many of which are vital for meeting clean water standards yet near the end of their use, are in critical need of upgrades or replacement. To meet this urgent and critical need, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that the difference between current capital spending and future costs, known as the funding gap, to be $3.0 to $19.4 billion annually for both drinking water and wastewater systems. This amount of funding is required to meet standards of water quality and to maintain and replace assets cost effectively. ASCE similarly awarded the nation's energy infrastructure a D+. That's a D, as in David. Improving our nation's energy infrastructure is critical. We can do this by modernizing electrical grid to be more intelligent, flexible, and resilient, which are the fundamental steps to efficient implementation of clean energy and securing American power supply. We must invest in the technology to generate clean energy and the capacity to transport that energy to where it is needed most. These initiatives draw on the massive American skilled labor force, creating good jobs that work for the 21st century. Expanding clean energy infrastructure will work toward mitigating the impact of changing climate and adapting to its current effects. The power grid must be properly managed in order to deliver the greatest benefit. The grid and other utilities are public good. They must be maintained and improved in ways that recognizes our reliance on them. We must start with passing a fully funded aid package. The people of the Northeast can't wait any longer to get to work making these crucial repairs. From there, strengthening the weakness in our infrastructure in a way that both addresses the reality of climate change and puts people to work must be our next priority. Lastly, by investing now in our energy infrastructure, including energy, gas, water infrastructure, we can cut down on the inefficiencies, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, create good American jobs, and ensure that our infrastructure is reliable in the face of the impacts of climate change. Dave, back to you.
Thank you very much, Mike. And now I'd like to call on Mark Norberg, Assistant to the General President of the Sheet Metal Air, Rail, and Transport Workers Union. Mark?
Thank you, Dave. Excuse me. As disaster relief coordinator for our 200,000 members, I witnessed firsthand the pain that our members go through during these crises and the immense effort it takes by them and their neighbors and the communities and states surrounding them in rebuilding. The cost to rebuild these communities is enormous, done in an emergency fashion, and I urge Congress to approve this funding without delay. I would also urge Congress to think ahead a little bit. You know, it costs, there's one price tag associated with doing this work in an emergency fashion, and there's much more price tag associated with doing it in a proactive manner. And I would urge Congress to start thinking ahead and rebuild our country's infrastructure with an eye towards a new reality as far as climate. And the benefits avoiding these emergency situations and also the energy payback would be enormous. It's time to, you know, for the adults to take over and start planning our country's future. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Mark. Now I'd like to call on George Cole, the Senior Director of the Communication Workers of America. George.
Thanks, Dave. Our members work and live in New York and New Jersey and suffered doubly during the destruction of Hurricane Sandy when surging water took down phone lines and interrupted vital communication services. In terms of our industry, the lack of a fully functioning communication system means many people were unable to notify relatives that they were okay and made relief efforts that much more difficult. Without power, cell phones and emergency radio batteries died, straining thousands. This breakdown in communications may not have received the attention that transportation and utility breakdowns received in the wake of the storm, but it reveals an urgent need to ensure our communication systems are there when we need them. A number of representatives have held relief and reconstruction efforts hostage to ideology rather than doing what Congress previously did for people and businesses in the Southeast who were devastated by Hurricane Katrina and the Gulf oil spill. The continuation of such behavior should not be acceptable at any level. New York and New Jersey are net exporters of tax revenues. It's outrageous that the aid package has not been passed. The House and Senate must pass that full package relief for those devastated by Sandy. We also know that at a fundamental level, Congress and the administration must address the real causes of global warming by implementing comprehensive policies to significantly reduce the production of greenhouse gases. We will not be able to address these climate change and devastation wrought by extreme weather events like Sandy unless we address the need for climate change in our political system. Here I'm speaking about the need to reform the Senate's filibuster rules, which lead to gridlock and fail to encourage any real debate on key issues such as climate change. The Senate is currently enmeshed in a system of arcane rules which guarantees that controversial bills will not even be discussed on the Senate floor, much less voted on. Except for those arcane rules, we would already have a form of comprehensive climate change legislation which, although it had majority support, never even received a vote. Without this structural change, we will continue to be condemned to picking up the pieces after the next Sandy and the droughts of the future. It is now inevitable. Given congressional gridlock and inaction, we need to recognize that oceans are warming and storms are worsening. We will need to adapt our infrastructure to survive storms like Sandy. For example, we must build an advanced smart energy infrastructure that utilizes fast and flexible and expansive communication systems that's properly maintained so that it will be reliable in any scenario, emergency or not. As a nation, we have a history of dealing compassionately with the victims of natural disasters. We cannot let New York and New Jersey aid languish one day more. Thanks, Dave.
And thank you very much, George. And finally, to round out the presentations from the fifth of the Blue-Green Alliance partners to be speaking today, John Kostiak, Vice President of Wildlife Conservation for the National Wildlife Federation. John?
Thanks, and good afternoon, everyone. National Wildlife Federation has over 4 million members and supporters. Many of them are in the area affected by Sandy. And I'm actually someone who grew up in New Jersey and spent many summers down the shore, so I'm really pleased to be able to lend my organization's support to this crucial effort to help the folks in this region cope with this disaster. The Sandy Relief Bill provides us with a really crucial opportunity, not just to rebuild the communities, but to safeguard them from more damaging storms, floods, and other disasters that accompany climate change. If Congress debates how to help the communities recover from Sandy, it will be crucial that they address the shortcomings of the past investments. We've known for a long time that communities that are built along the coast and in floodplains are vulnerable. These locations have a certain amount of inherent danger. In the past few decades, we've been watching as that risk has steadily increased before our eyes, as the sea levels have risen and the storms have become more intense. Munich Re and the reinsurance company recently came out with a report, and it showed that our losses from weather-related disasters have grown fivefold in the past three decades. That's in contrast with in Europe, where they've grown twofold. Other countries, such as the Netherlands, have made large-scale infrastructure investments to prepare for this reality and safeguard their communities from severe flooding. Here in the United States, some cities have begun drawing up the necessary adaptation plans, but the federal government has largely had its head in the sand, especially when it comes to the money. Through the Federal Flood Insurance Program and disaster relief programs, the federal government has spent many billions effectively encouraging building in some of these hazardous areas. With this latest investment now coming forward with an opportunity to rebuild along the coast in a smarter way, we have an opportunity to build more resilient buildings and transportation and energy systems. There's also an enormous opportunity to rebuild the natural defenses that protect coastal communities that have done so for many thousands of years, such as oyster reefs and coastal wetlands and barrier islands. Using these natural defenses is oftentimes far more cost-effective than relying upon hard structures, and it provides the additional benefit of serving important fish and wildlife habitat. We can restore this habitat with one of our threatened wildlife around for our kids and grandchildren. We can also ensure a healthy commercial and recreational fishery. And finally, this bill, I think, provides a really important learning laboratory for the major investment we will need to make in climate preparedness going forward that will ultimately need to be wrapped into a comprehensive climate change bill. Now more than ever, we need the United States to be the leader in both fighting global warming pollution and preparing for global warming's worst impacts. It's the only way to safeguard our communities and our economic future. There are millions of people who are standing ready to carry out this essential work if Congress will only agree to kickstart it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, John. And now, Rachel, we'd like you to open up the phone lines for any questions that reporters might have for us.
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. If you are using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Please hold while we wait for the first question.
Perhaps while we're waiting for that question, it's interesting to note that today's debate in the House of Representatives is taking place against the backdrop of the release late on Friday of the most recent National Climate Assessment, which has come out from the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which is a mandated report produced by the United States government periodically to report on the impacts of climate change here in the United States. And if any of us needed any additional prompting about the seriousness of the issue of climate change and the need to address it through looking in particular at the dilapidated state of our infrastructure, I encourage people to review that National Climate Assessment and attend one of the 8 hearings that will take place over the next couple of months around the country to gather additional information as the U.S. government finalizes that report on the serious impacts that we're already seeing unfold on climate change in the country today.
The first question comes from Steve Strunsky from the Star Ledger. Steve, please state your question.
Hi, gentlemen. I wonder if you could state whether the priority here is to get money in the area quickly to create jobs or to make sure that the kinds of work that is done with this relief money is the smart work that you are talking about, and are they not in a way at odds with each other?
Well, this is David Foster responding first, and then others may have comments to say as well. I don't think these two issues are in contradistinction to each other at all. Although it is clear that we as a nation need to be stepping up and doing our infrastructure investment in a way that's consistent with both being prepared for the threats of climate change that currently exist, and that additionally we do it in a way that allows us to ameliorate some of the worst impacts that can still be avoided. So this is, of course, extremely important from our perspective that these two issues really be merged as complementary and that they not be seen as in some way in conflict with each other. I think John from the National Wildlife Federation mentioned that in parts of Europe, European infrastructure planners are far ahead of us in thinking through how to use the infrastructure investments that climate change is requiring in a way that is thoughtful and planful. We need to be doing that as well. I think Mike Langford mentioned half a dozen different areas in which our infrastructure is a threat, and by authorizing the money in Congress today, we are not authorizing to do things foolishly. We're authorizing to do things quickly and to do it thoughtfully. Any other comments?
This is John Costier from National Wildlife Federation. I would agree with that. And I would also add that we're not talking about the need for any great technological innovation. There are many technologies that are ready off the shelf to be put on the ground to make our communities more resilient and more prepared. I mean, we know how to rebuild wetlands and barrier reefs and oyster reefs and barrier islands. Those have all been done around the world. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. I think the same can be said about some of the key investments that need to be made in the built infrastructure as well, in the built environment.
This is Mike Langford. I'd just like to add to the fact that I agree with both John and Dave, but you have to remember, these are infrastructures that were designed and built in the 30s and 40s, and up to date, it's just been a Band-Aid approach to these things, and this is where there's serious money needs to be in place to bring this new technology into place and get away from the Band-Aid approach. So that's where, you know, this goes hand in hand with the everything that everybody's saying here. So you have to keep that in mind.
Thank you, gentlemen.
The next question comes from Amina Saeed with CNA. Amina, please state your question.
Yes, thank you. I was curious to know if you all have a list of how many wastewater treatment utilities were impacted, or waste, generally water utilities in these states were impacted by, and what exactly do you all propose should be done, could be done to help and build more resiliency in these utilities?
Mike Langford, do you want to take first crack at that?
Well, I can't give you an exact number of how many were impacted. I mean, there's a lot of these utilities are in desperate need of that whole infrastructure rebuilt. And, you know, you heard me say earlier that they were rated in the wastewater side a D minus, and in the wastewater side a D. So there's pipes need to be replaced. There's wooden water pipes in the ground as we speak today. And you lose a tremendous amount of fresh water on a daily basis that never gets consumed. It just gets wasted through the process of the bad infrastructure. And there's where the dollars can be spent to really, you know, it would green up the economy. It would conserve energy. It does everything that we're talking about. I don't know if I really answered your question to the detail you were asking for, but I can't answer exactly how many.
Okay. Could you talk about what exactly would be needed to, you know, can you give a few more examples of what could be done to these utilities to make them more resilient?
Well, you look at the overhead compared to underground lines departments and stuff, to where more infrastructure could be put underground compared to pole snapping or trees landing on branches landing on power lines to knock them out. Those are all things that could be redesigned, replanned. I mean, they have an enormous amount of planning groups, but the resources just aren't there to construct and to build these. So there's where it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort by everybody to accomplish that.
Okay. Thank you.
This is David Foster. You know, quite a number of water treatment systems in coastal areas in both the eastern United States and the western United States are built in anticipation of storm surges of only a certain level. And when the storm surges with rising sea levels, coupled with more intense storms, their capacity to keep salt water out of the freshwater systems is severely challenged. And so there are a number of cities around the country already, San Francisco, for example, which has understood that its water systems can no longer adequately handle the anticipated storm surges of rising oceans. And so they're having to rebuild the system to be able to keep salt water out of from contaminating the freshwater system. And I think as we saw rather poignantly on the front page or the business section of the New York Times over the weekend, the acres of ruined automobiles where salt water got inside the combustion engines and interiors of those automobiles, they're simply mechanical systems that we have today are inconsistent with that level of exposure to salt water. And so that's a problem on coastal area water treatment systems all around the United States.
Gotcha. May I know, sir, your name? I'm sorry, I didn't catch
This is David Foster from the Blue Green Alliance.
Thank you, David.
The next question comes from David Moberg. David, please state your question.
Yes, I wondered for any of the labor officials on the call, whether there's anything about Sandy or other recent events or recent information that has made you much more concerned about global warming, or whether this is a longstanding position you've held.
Mark or George or Mike, any of you want to answer that? I would just say, David, that from historically the Blue-Green Alliance, 10 unions that belong to it have all had positions recognizing the seriousness of climate change dating back for several years. So their involvement in the Blue-Green Alliance and our strong advocacy on the importance of solving climate change dates to their membership in our partnership, which is, as they said, several years ago. How about Mark or George, Mike, of you want to comment on that?
Well, David, I think you summed it up there. I mean, it's, everybody's belongs to the Blue-Green because of their strong feelings on, some of the things that need to help protect the world that we live in. And again, just rebuilding that infrastructure would conserve so much gas, electric, and water. You've got gas lines, things blowing up around the country because they're so outdated. You've got 1940 technology and an electrical grid system that's operating this country. You've got wooden water pipes in the ground that still operating around this country. That in itself would green up the economy, put thousands and thousands of good-paying jobs of people working again. These are not just part-time jobs. These are full-time, permanent jobs because you still have to operate and maintain all these systems. So, our commitment is on both ends is greening up the economy and the whole infrastructure.
At CWA, we adopted a policy some years ago about climate change, and it's important, and joined Blue Green because we thought that the debate should be about fact-based discussion on climate change, one, and then two, the need to have unions in America and union work in America. So the Storm Sandy is just what we see. It's the inevitability of climate change is happening. It's going to get worse. There'll be more and more of these storms. But it wasn't Sandy per se that put us into this position.
This is Mike Langford. To me, Sandy is just now highlighted what more of the same might continue. And I think this is going to raise public awareness. As utility workers, that's our goal, is literally go around the nation, city by city, and talking to folks, politicians, on how vulnerable our system is, and legislators, and governors, and the regulators, the Public Service Commission, to explain to them the vulnerabilities of the system, but give them the fixes also. So that's our position on this.
Hey, this is Mark Marburg. I can't understand how you can be a citizen of this country or a citizen of the world and not be alarmed at what you observe in year to year with the elevated temperatures and the the severity of the storms that go on and the loss in life and not want to do something to reverse the course of these calamities and get on top of the situation. There's no reason not to do this. Even if you stick your head in the sand and claim there's no energy, there's no climate change, well, you know, we can use our treasury for much better things than drilling for more oil, especially when we have such abundant solar and wind resources in this country. It is astounding to me that we're still arguing over this at this point in time.
Any more questions, Rachel?
The next question comes from Amanda Pellucci. Amanda, please state your question.
Hi. I'm wondering, and this question is mostly for Mike, but in the debate, in the House bill that they're currently debating on the floor includes an additional, possibility of an additional $33 billion in aid, which includes resiliency funds for clean water and drinking water in aid to states. I was just wondering what your members think about this, how this might help you, and any other thoughts you might have on amendments that were taken up or not taken up in the bill.
Well, no, our members, obviously, you know, they want to see, you know, their major goal is to protect the communities that they serve, to make sure that when it comes to fresh water, that they're getting the highest quality of water in the world. And the way it is today is with a lot of these cities doing budget cuts, and then when they aren't putting the necessary repairs, it impacts our members. And even when they downsize, they have literally downsized in all aspects of the utility industry, and they rely a lot on mutual aid. But when you bring people in, like with the electric system, no electric system is the same from state to state to state. So it really impacts the workers that are on the current property, because now they basically have to babysit these new workers coming in. So you don't really get the most productivity out of it. So by putting more folks on who do the day-to-day work, you'll get a better quality of water, you'll get better systems, and by putting money into that system, you know, the wastewater plants, the freshwater plants, the transmission and distribution system, these dollars would be more than welcome to put America back on track to where they need, not a B minus, but an A plus is where we should be, and the goal we should be trying for.
Amanda, this is David Foster. Let me just add that as a coalition, we're very supportive of the amendment to add the $33 billion in Sandy relief that's being discussed today. And we're quite opposed to these various amendments that are trying to cut discretionary funding in other parts of the federal budget in order to, quote, pay for the relief bill. That is not the way disaster relief has been historically handled in this country. It sets a terrible precedent. And really takes out the on the backs of a variety of other needs of the country, the very important Recovery Act efforts in New York and New Jersey. I would also just say that two of the most important infrastructure programs we have in this country that are funded federally, the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund and the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, have been sorely cut over the last few years, which is highly ironic given that these are revolving funds from which the states and local communities borrow money for major water infrastructure projects and then repay it. And if anything, given the dilapidated state of our water infrastructure that Mike Langford has been talking about, now in a time of cheap borrowing rates, this is the time we ought to be increasing those revolving funds, not cutting.
Thank you.
Next question.
It appears there are no further questions in the queue at this time.
Okay. I guess if there are no other questions, I want to thank all of you for joining us today to have this important discussion about the Sandy relief bill, climate change, and the need for infrastructure investments today. And I also want to thank all of our spokespeople here today from the various Blue-Green Alliance partners, Mike Langford of Utility Workers, Mark Zorberg of Sheet Metal, George Cole of the Communication Workers, and John Kostiak of the National Wildlife Federation. Thanks to all of you, and we appreciate your participation with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your line at this time.